Blog Talk Radio.
This is for you, Kings fans, wherever you may be. All the frustration and disappointment of the past is gone.
It is February 28th, 2018, and we are back with another episode of the JewelCast, our sixth one of the season, I believe. We've been off for about a month, and in that time, a whole lot has happened. So we're going to go ahead and launch right into it, as we usually do. Today, I am joined by Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
So today, we are basking in the afterglow of two wins over the Vegas Golden Knights, who I probably would have been pleased to get one of those two victories, and it looked a lot like we were only going to get one of those victories. It was fun listening to the intro, because I was reminded of Jim doing the pre-goal celebration when Alec Martinez had that rebound lineup for him, and I haven't heard him overshadow the announcer like that. At least I had before that goal in 2014, and he's been doing a little bit more. And the one on Monday was one of the larger ones I can remember over Alex Foss, which is always fun. And after that happened, I forget whether he toned it down a little bit for the Dustin Brown goal, but he felt, I think, the way a lot of us felt in the aftermath of that. What were your thoughts coming out of the first game, Sarah?
I mean, I still don't believe that it happened. Like it feels where has this team been? You know, coming out of the first game, it felt good because it was a little bit of redemption for the way that the one against Edmonton ended. And in general, it was just good to beat Las Vegas. Like, we've been waiting for it, and anyone who beats them, I'm incredibly happy. coming out of the first one, I was like, okay, that was great. Jonathan Quick played really great. The next night I was just really prepared for it to be a disaster. Back to back, home and home, Jack Campbell, who knew what he was going to do. So I was really not expecting the performance we got out of them last night, and surprise, they did much better than expected, for me at least.
Yeah, and I was texting a friend on Monday, I can't believe how much I hate this team already, given that they've existed for, well, they've been playing hockey for like four or
right.
five months. The Kings have played them now a grand total of four times. And if maybe it's envy, maybe it's the most common refrain I've seen online, which is these fans have not suffered enough to have a team that's this good. But
exactly.
In either direction, I was surprised at how much I really wanted the Kings to, like, especially grab one of these wins. But
yeah,
the back-to-back, it's so great. And I think this is the second time that we've recorded out of six episodes this season where we've been on like a really high note. I think there was, one of the recordings we had earlier this year, I think, was in the middle or near the end of that six or seven game winning streak. And we were sort of gloating about how optimistic the site had been before the season compared to the rest of the media, compared to some Kings fans. And then, you know, since then it's become very clear that it's going to be a fight to the finish regardless.
Yeah.
So
reality set in.
I mean, Yeah, just a little bit. So I guess let's stick with the talking about Vegas before we move on to the trade deadline and the bigger changes. So like, are you more reflecting on the first game's performance where the Kings sort of found themselves overwhelmed as they have so often this year, and maybe just getting those points because of a ferocious late charge, or are you dwelling more on the second game where they sort of learn from their mistakes?
Yeah, I think I'm thinking more about the second game because we had seen them put together that kind of dominant performance against teams where, you know, the Buffalo Sabres, no matter how long it had been since the Kings had won in Buffalo, are not a good team. You know, so seeing them coming out and just, you know, destroying Buffalo was refreshing, but not really a surprise. And, you know, same for, you know, the same performance they had against Chicago, who are not a good team this year. You know, it was good to see, but so to see them come out on the back, you know, after playing a grueling game the night before, going into overtime, heading right to Vegas, and seeing them pull out a game where they actually played the full 60 minutes and didn't just kind of sit back and let things happen. And also, that it was the kind of game, it felt like an Anaheim game in many ways, because Vegas is very physical, very scrappy. They've got Ryan Reeves there who's trying to get in everyone's heads and cause trouble.
Sure.
But unlike with the Ducks, where I feel like we haven't necessarily had an answer to, you know, the Ryan Keslers and, you know, Corey Perrys and the way they try to get in to people's heads, I felt like they just sort of brushed off Ryan Reeves and let him do his thing and take dumb penalties. And you know, it was good to see them not letting Vegas's antics get into their heads, and that the Kings just kept playing their game, which is not what I expected on the back of a back-to-back. The performance they put out was just very surprising based on what we've seen in the sort of doldrums of this season.
Yeah, and I think it's the most complimentary that I've been of the Kings after a game in which they gave up 40 shots. But maybe it was in comparison to the night before, where Quick was repeatedly making, you know, grade A plus saves. Campbell obviously was very good, and we'll talk more about the Campbell story in a minute. But there was definitely a sense that for once it was the other team that was sort of putting shots on net, but not particularly dangerous ones. I feel like when we play against Vegas, or when we watch Vegas against other teams, it's like watching a team with three or four or five Alex Iafallos on the ice at the same time, where every time a puck bounces away from somebody, you know that Vegas is going to get it. And especially with Smith and Marchessault and Carlson on the ice yesterday and on Monday, it felt like repeatedly the Kings would, you know, knock a puck away, make a nice defensive play, block a shot. And before I could, you know, be optimistic about what was going to happen next, they had the puck back and they were looking for a chance. And the Kings didn't even, you know, they blocked 18 shots yesterday, which isn't high by their standards. I think Derek Forbert was actually the only player who blocked more than one shot yesterday. So it wasn't even that they were selling out necessarily as much as they often do. They just had the game under control, and it was a nice feeling. So in the building on that, then, with the first game's sort of late charge, it, you know, I am inclined to sort of take your tack that this second game was maybe more indicative of what this team can do down the stretch, because they're going to be seeing teams that they've played before and maybe have a chance to game plan for the way they did on Tuesday. But are you still concerned about the slow starts, like the one that we saw on Monday?
Yeah. I mean, I don't always believe that once they get down that they're going to come back. You know, the schedule isn't going to do them any favors. But it was good to see that kind of resilience that I don't think we've seen in a while, especially like in that losing stretch where it was just like, well, they go down 2-0, like the game's over. Let's just go home. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if they've all turned a page, if, you know, the passing of the trade deadline and all of that has, you know, freed them of their hockey anxieties or something, I don't know. And, you know, we'll see in the next couple of games if they're still kind of plagued by the same mistakes that we saw that in these games, at least Vegas wasn't necessarily able to capitalize on, you know, the turnovers and the stuck in their own zone kind of stuff. It would be nice to see more consistent effort, which I feel like has been the story the whole season, is that not everyone is actually trying real hard the whole time. And, you know, that puts them at a disadvantage whenever you're down two goals by the end of the first period.
Right. And I was surprised to hear that the game on Monday was the first time the Kings had won after being down multiple goals in the third period, because it feels like, as you said, every time they've been down a couple goals in the third period, they haven't come away with a win, and it's been a struggle. But they do usually seem to get one goal back. They've sent a couple games to overtime. So it's sort of a matter of finding that effort earlier. And I always hear the complaint that the Kings should play in the first 5 minutes like they do in the last 5 minutes. And that, I don't think that's ever going to happen. I don't think any team is really capable of doing that. Mm-hmm. But the idea that the Kings can get an early lead like they did on Tuesday and then clamp down is something that they would have had no trouble doing in past seasons. And the fact they were able to do it on Tuesday was encouraging for sure.
Yeah.
Other takeaway, I think, from yesterday was the goaltending situation and the surprisingly excellent performance that Campbell put in. The move to get rid of Darcy Kemper was more of a flashpoint, I think, than I expected around Kings fans. I think that I assumed we were so used to seeing backup goalies head off into the sunset that we were going to be a little more zen about Kemper, but I also think that there was a definite downgrade from Kemper to whoever the Kings replaced him with. Is it too early, Sarah, to chalk that up as an obvious win for the Kings?
Yes and no, because
good.
he could easily not be the same goalie the next time we see him. But the Kings have such, you know, Bill Ranford and Dusty Emu are they're magic, like they're wizards. I don't know what they're doing, but they have managed to turn every backup goalie the Kings have had, except for Jeff Zatkoff, rest his soul, in Columbus now, into someone who can at least hold water. And, you know, and it isn't Jonathan Quick isn't going to necessarily steal a game from you, but they're doing something amazing with these guys. And so I think that, you know, we all kind of panicked because there wasn't actually any indication from the organization at first that Campbell was the one who was going to get brought up. And that it kind of seemed like they were like, oh, we're just going to carry three guys and let them battle. There was a little bit of gamesmanship there. So I think a lot of us were like, what? They're going to put this completely new stranger guy, this kid who's only played a couple games with terrible Arizona, into being our starting goalie or our backup goalie. And then, oh, surprise, here's Jack Campbell. So I feel like that was a lot of the panic of just having no idea what they were going to do with the position. But if he continues to perform like that in the, you know, three starts that he's going to get, you know, I retract every annoying, whiny comment I made about, you know, what in the world they're doing with this.
And I took the position immediately that I had no qualms about this over the long term. And it was more that short-term thing that was going to answer every question we had. If Campbell plays every back-to-back and doesn't play in any other games this season, he could potentially have two games against Arizona, along with this game against Vegas and one more in a Minnesota-Winnipeg back-to-back, where there's really, again, not an easy matchup in that particular set. But the idea that Campbell only has to play twice against Arizona and one more tough road matchup down the stretch is encouraging. but if I don't think there's any way that Campbell will get more than those four games, unless heaven forbid, Quick, you know, sustains some sort of knock, is very possible.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a really cool thing for Campbell, forgetting all of the other implications of Campbell beating Vegas in Vegas.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to, you know, I've read a little bit about his kind of backstory, and, you know, I have a lot of friends who are Stars fans, so I kind of had an awareness of him before he came to the Kings. And just the work that the Kings organization did with him to help rebuild his game. You know, there's interviews and quotes with him and Dusty both talking about how he just completely lost track of what he was trying to do and started trying to emulate other goaltenders, which sometimes is fine, but sometimes you're trying to emulate a guy who's, you know, 4 or 5 inches taller than you. And so, you know, the same movements and the same style isn't going to work for you. And they basically had to just tear his whole game down and start over again. And I mean, they, regardless of how he performs in the NHL, you know, he's been amazing in Ontario. And so just seeing kind of the culmination of all the work that they did to get, you know, this former first round draft pick back on track is impressive, you know, no matter where his career goes from here.
Yeah, and Campbell is under contract for the next two seasons after this one. They signed him back in November and to a very, very generous team-friendly contract of, I think it's a sub-$1 million deal. So the plan apparently, and John Rosen was mentioning this on Twitter in some reply to somebody, is to have Cal Peterson up apparently full-time in 2019-2020. Maybe to give him a few starts next season, depending on how things go. And it's kind of exciting because Ranford and Emu, at least in the last decade, have not had a chance to really work with a blue chip prospect since Jonathan Bernier. And forgive me for not knowing the exact goaltending pipeline in 2009 and 2010, but I don't know how much work Emu did. I think Ranford was on the coaching staff at that point. It's going to be fun to see what these guys can do with a full-time, you know, as Rosen called him, a blue-chip goalie prospect again.
Yeah. Yeah. I also definitely forgot how long Jonathan Quick's contract is, and I just looked, and I need to look away.
Is it up here in 2022 or
23? 2022-23 is the last year. So 23-24, he's gone to the goalie house in the farm. They'll probably re-sign him for another 8 years. I don't know. But I love him, but he's also here forever. But, you know, kind of what you said about Cal Peterson, expecting him to kind of be up here, you know, basically after Jack Campbell's contract is up, because you would think that if Campbell's backing up full time next year and the year after, he's going to pull I want to go somewhere and be a starter. But, you know, that would give Peterson 3 years probably of being before they have to decide what they're doing next. So yeah
once which is I'm pretty sure and I'm pretty sure that's exactly the timetable Bernier was on. I want to say he spent 3 years as the backup before the Kings made that particular decision, which over time I think has mostly been validated, but you'll still find people willing to argue that point, especially since Bernier had a nice bounce back season. With Peterson, I think I don't even want to talk about that plan really, like what the goalie succession plan is. I'm thinking of the John Mulaney joke where they mentioned he's going to be paying for a house until 2029. And he goes, 2029, that's not a real year. And that's how I think of these contracts. Like there's no way that, in 2023, I'm going to have any idea about anything that's going on in the world.
That's fake.
So it'll be nice, and we can answer those questions on a podcast in 2021 if we're all still around. But the more immediate concern, I think, is the other stars on this Kings team and whether Jeff Carter is ready to carry this team down the stretch, or at least let Andre Kopitar have a little bit of a break from carrying the team on his back. I think Kopitar at this point, if I remember right from reading today, has the second largest lead over a team's second leading scorer. I think Taylor Hall has like 29 or 30 more points than the Devils' second leading scorer, whereas Kopitar is, I think, 25 or 26 points ahead of Dustin Brown. I wrote an article about Jeff Carter and what he can bring to the table. I don't think there's anything particularly surprising that I uncovered in the article, even though you should still read it. Just trying to get an idea of where he was going to chip in. First of all, Sarah, he's been back to pretty much full-time usage since returning. Aside from the PK, where I don't think he's gotten a whole lot of time, he's playing pretty much the same amount of minutes that he would have been before the injury.
Yeah.
You have any concerns about Carter getting sort of heavy back-to-back usage? Do you think that the Kings just waited as long as possible so they could play him at full 100%?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they I don't think he would have come back if he I would like to think if he wasn't completely ready.
Yeah.
And you know, I know that I've seen some criticism of like, well, you know, his timing's not totally there and, you know, maybe he should have sat out some more and just done some more practices with the team. But I feel like whenever you hear guys talk about, you know, coming back after a long-term injury is that no matter what, no matter how hard your team practices, no matter how many practices you go to, it never really replicates a game situation. And so, you know, if,
yeah.
you know, his skating obviously is up to par, like the skating is what I worried about the most. You know, you're coming off of a significant ankle injury. Like I twist my ankle and I'm like, well, I can't skate again for the next 6 months. Like I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, coming off of an injury like that, I was really worried that, you know, one of his biggest strengths is his skating. And he doesn't look
right.
any different than before. So, you know, the skating's there, the timing's going to come, you know, it's not like, you know, you don't see him on a shift looking like he's kind of like cheating or, you know, not putting out max effort because he's, you know, the conditioning is bad. I mean, he's just a freak of nature in many ways. Like just, he's magical. You know, so I think, you know, coming back the first game, I was a little worried, but, you know, his first shift in the first game back was just, he was a wrecking ball. You know, he hit a guy, he had a couple of good shots. He had, was busy around the net. I was like, okay, never mind. I'm not worried. Like, you know, the passing and the timing on plays will come back. You know, the goal he got last night, like he just like banged it in like it was nothing. Like, oh, look, I'm here. I'm standing in front of the net. Here's a goal. Bye. You know, it didn't look any different than he did before the injury. So I'm so happy.
Yeah, and the usage yesterday, that was another nice thing about the Kings having a lead. I was going to say that the Kings could play him less, and John Stevens called a timeout to give Carter more power play time, but he only played 10 minutes at even strength yesterday, which I think is less
yeah.
than probably 7 or 8 of the Kings forwards. Mitchell, Thompson, Iafallo, Reeder, Kempe all played more, along with Kopitar and Brown, of course. So there was a nice opportunity for Carter and Toffoli and Pearson too, who each played under 15 minutes and, you know, 10 or 11 minutes at even strength, to give them a little time off too. But I do stand corrected. Carter actually did have a couple PK shifts yesterday. He had one early in the game for about 20-30 seconds, and then he came out in the third period for another PK when the Kings already had that 2-goal lead. One thing I touched on in the article is comparing his PK work last year to what Nate Thompson and Torrey Mitchell have done. Of course, Trevor Lewis is still injured. We know Kopitar and Brown is the number one shorthanded unit, and they're probably going to stay that way. Who do you want to see killing penalties when everybody's healthy again on that second unit.
Oh, man. You know, I as good as Jeff Carter is killing penalties, I kind of would like to see him not be doing it unless, you know, I kind of think of him in the same way as they kind of pulled, you know, Tyler Toffoli off of the penalty kill unit too, you know, give some other guys a chance, you know, conserve Tyler more for offensive situations, or maybe, you know, if you're in the unfortunate situation where you're killing a penalty and you're still down a goal and you're very close to the end of the game, you know, you can put someone like Tyler and Jeff in who will not only be good at killing the penalty, but might also be better at springing something going the other way. You know, or Trevor Lewis, which apparently is his specialty, his weird shorthanded goals.
Sure.
It's kind of weird that we haven't heard much about him. But yeah, I mean, I'm not 100% sold on Nate Thompson, but just because I just remember him on the Ducks, and I know that everyone from Ottawa was like, good riddance to this guy.
Yeah.
I haven't hated him here, but he also hasn't had to, he's been very unnoticeable, which is good. But, you know, he's certainly a better skater than some of the, you know, bottom six kind of guys that we've seen over the years. If anything, I would pick him to sit just because of what I know of his stats from his time in Ottawa that were basically like, he's going to kill penalties, but maybe not great at it. But, you know, the penalty kill stats have actually not been great for the Kings over the month of February. At one point I looked and they literally had the worst penalty kill in the league. And then I closed the browser window because it made me unhappy. And I didn't want to research anymore because then I was going to be more mad. I don't know if that's so much a symptom of the personnel on the penalty kill or just the team as a whole was just not so great. And so it, you know, they looked better against Vegas, who have one of the better power plays in the league. So maybe they fixed it.
And I think Mitchell has sort of that that Jordan Nolan quality where he looks really active even if he's not playing well. And Nate Thompson is not that kind of player. Like, he's, as you said, he doesn't stick out. So you notice him when he's getting caught in his own zone, which has happened a few times already, or fortunately for him, when he's, you know, winning a faceoff or he's on the penalty kill, which I don't think, at least since he's come over, I don't remember him really being bitten by any sort of error in his own zone or making any, you know, foolish plays on the penalty kill. So in that respect, he's doing all right. But I think he's got played 2 minutes of shorthanded time a game since arriving, which is only behind Kopitar on the Kings the full season. So,
cool.
Yeah. Hmm. So Lewis is going to come back, and Lewis is I assume going to slot right back in. So it'll be interesting to see where they go with Thompson or Mitchell, because I think that's who is going to be on that second unit, unless they do decide to return to Carter. And maybe that'll be something that they do in the playoffs or down the stretch. But it's a, you know, it's a decent problem to have if Thompson and Mitchell are playing well on the penalty kill. And Mitchell, I think, has been maybe struggling a little bit more than Thompson has so far with the PK, although he's also a little better at generating chances the other way. So that covers at least a couple of the newer acquisitions. So as we get to the rest of the deadline stuff, I think we need to talk about Dion Phaneuf. When Phaneuf came over, Robin and James, who are not on the podcast, shout out to Robin and James, had diametrically opposed opinions on the Phaneuf move. Robin wrote about it on our site. James wrote about it on – J. James, that is, wrote about it on Ottawa's site. And I think the early returns, as we might have expected, are mixed. Phaneuf has gotten headlines for the power play scoring, and that's probably what the rest of the the league's fan base and assorted interested observers have heard about. But what do you think about the overall game FNUF has brought so far?
I've been more pleased than I expected to be, because he's
sure.
been having a terrible year in Ottawa, which, you know, is part on him, is part on being paired with Cody Ceci, who's also terrible, is part on just Ottawa being bad. But, you know, he also was not great in Toronto either. But it basically is like Vinny LeCavalier, Jerome Iginla, you know, take three of bringing in an older player, maybe not the fastest, maybe not the most agile, but add something to the team in hockey IQ and in the power play. He definitely, like, his passing is great. If he gets caught out of position or someone faster than him goes past him, you're done, which we all knew was kind of the drawback of Dion Phaneuf. It's a little disappointing that, you know, he pushed Paul Ledoux out of the lineup, because I think that, you know, Ledoux being a, you know, faster puck moving kind of guy, which is something that you're always in need of, you know, that's kind of a disappointment, but I can't be as mad as I first was, because he's not completely, you know, useless. To be less than charitable, you know, he definitely, you know, is contributing. The guys all seem to like him. You know, for some reason, they, despite all of the cup winning veterans in this team, they keep saying they need more, you know, experienced voices, and maybe he can kind of do that. He's very well respected by everyone. He hasn't been a total disaster, and I feel like that's what, you know, the takes of, you know, some people like Robin was expecting, was he's going to be terrible and everything's going to be awful and we're all going to die. And I think that he's been fine. You know, I'm more concerned about, like, Drew Doughty having, like, really terrible games and giving really bad, you know, turnovers and stuff than I am that Dion Phaneuf is slow. Like, fine.
Yeah, and Phaneuf, I don't know. He's played, let's see, how much has Dion Phaneuf played so far? He's averaging 16 and a half minutes a game at even strength, plus 2.5 minutes on the power play, so about 19 minutes a game so far, which is a lot for Dion Phaneuf. It's a lot on a team where Derek Forbert was averaging 21 minutes a game, and I don't know where his minutes. I don't know if Phaneuf is taking. Oh, that's not in your favor either.
I didn't realize it was that much. That's nothing against Derek Forbert, but that's a lot of Derek Forbert.
And he played over 20 minutes yesterday too. Hockey. I'm checking on Hockey Viz right now to sort of see where Phaneuf's minutes have been coming from. And the biggest drop, as you might or may or may not expect, has been with Muzzin comparatively. Forbert has seen his minutes fall a little bit. Muzzin's have gone down. Martinez's and Doughty's have been pretty stable. And there's been less use, of course, for whoever the sixth defenseman happens to be, which has been Follin lately. So if you envision that those Phaneuf minutes are coming a little bit from Muzzin, a little bit from Martinez or Doughty, and a lot from that sixth guy, then, you know, you can, maybe you're calling it a push. But I'm glad you kind of brought up what Doughty's been doing lately, because I think he and Muzzin and to an extent Martinez have been a little more mistake prone lately, and maybe that's just a result of the Kings being on the road and having some rough games, but at least the last few nights they've all been a little off their games. So I am still concerned about Forbert down the stretch, Phaneuf down the stretch, but I think it's fair to expect more from the guys who are, you know, have been on the Kings for a while and should be doing better than they are.
Yeah.
Do you think Madu comes back into the lineup?
I want him to, but I feel like the only, you know, they're not going to healthy scratch five of the, you know, other six players. Bolin is really the only one who, you know, would be able to be scratched. And I, you know, he's had bad games. He's had better games, but he's kind of the only candidate to get scratched. I would like to think that they would play him in a game, because otherwise, what's the point of him being here? You know, I'd much rather see him playing games in Ontario, getting top line minutes, than just sitting around waiting for something to happen. You know, I know Kevin Gravel passed the waivers standpoint, so they can't send him down without someone maybe taking him. I hope, I mean, at least maybe in these Arizona games, or, you know, once, knock on wood or whatever, if or when the Kings get more solidly into a playoff spot, they might tinker. But, you know, they have a lineup. It's working for them. Paul Adu is in defenseman purgatory for some reason. And, you know, he definitely, you know, there's one goal that I remember. He just was watching the puck and not the player, and oops, there's a goal. But, you know, I don't know that, like, scratching a guy for the rest of eternity, you know, is really going to give him the chance to learn from his mistakes. But I try to have faith in John Stevens, because he's always been very good with the defenseman. That he has a plan for whatever is going on there, but it's just a little weird. You know, right shot, puck moving, agile defensemen are a pretty rare commodity, and we've got one just chilling for some reason.
Yeah. And it's the age old. Is there, at least down the stretch, are you going to give minutes to a younger guy who maybe has a higher ceiling? Ludo's, and he's played, I think, 7 or 8 games or something. He's been really good, I think, in those games. There's actually on, I think, Corsica is the website. They have a game score measure that attempts to measure how effective skaters have been on a game-by-game basis in various areas. Kopitar is something like 40th in the league. So I'm willing to immediately throw it out the window, because I'm very offended by that. But Ledoux is, I think, the best King in that measure, in very limited minutes and very limited games, of course. But so far, he's, you know, in the games he's been out there, his possession numbers have been good. He's carried the play pretty well. So it's, another problem you're okay with having for the most part. But, yeah, I think if the Kings start to struggle at all, I think Ledoux will get in. And maybe in that case, we don't want to see Ledoux.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, if everything was perfect. So I guess then we've gone 38 minutes into the podcast without talking about Andrei Kopitar. So, Sarah, talk about Andrei Kopitar. Whatever you want.
I mean, can we just spend the rest of the podcast talking about Andrei Kopitar? First off, Andre Kopitar smiled at me in Carolina, and I still haven't recovered. This has nothing to do with his hockey, and I'm sure there's someone out there who's, it's very important. I was wearing a Slovenia jersey, and he looked at me and he smiled, and I think I died on the spot. And there's probably someone out there right now who is taking me less seriously as a hockey person, and I don't care. It was amazing.
There's also probably somebody out there who wants to insist that Andrei Kopitar was looking at them instead, but they're wrong, correct?
They're absolutely wrong. Absolutely wrong.
Okay, good. I'm glad we cleared that up.
I mean, I could watch the goal that he scored last night where he just, like, whoop, like, slid the puck under Lucas Cisa's stick. Like it was nothing. I could watch that on repeat forever. I don't know how he's doing it, but he's had the most amazing bounce back year. When I was in Carolina in my Andrei Kopitar Slovenia jersey, I was actually in line to buy some food, and the guy working the register looked at me and goes, "You must really love Anshul Kopitar, don't you?" I'm like, and I just blurted without even thinking, like, to say something more like mature and well-rounded. I just said, "I love him and he's perfect." And the guy started laughing. But then, you know, this random food cashier in Raleigh, North Carolina, was having a conversation with me about Anshul Kopitar. And he's like, "Yeah, like, I knew he'd bounce back after last year, and his stats are really good this year." And I was like, "This is the best day of my life." But, you know, I think people worried a lot about last year. But, you know, as the season went on and we went into the off season and learned kind of more the extent of, you know, he was kind of battling through some injuries and wasn't really ever playing at 100%, really explained a lot about, you know, his performance last year and what we saw out of him. And, you know, between being able to start this year fully healthy and, you know, I'm sure that the coaching change, you know, revitalized him just the same way as it has many of the other players, you know, being able to come back to work basically and have fun, I think has really meant a lot. And just what he's done this year has been amazing. And I he really should win every single award possible.
I have nothing to add. I have a lot of things to add, but I'm going to save it. the goal yesterday, and there's the very relevant argument that it was Luka Spiza playing defense and Maxime Lagesse in goal, but that was the whole doubleheader, was Kopitar stick handling through guys in the neutral zone. And
yeah,
there's, you know, I think I don't know the measures off the top of my head. I know that Corey from Shutdown Line, who does a lot of the the hard data gathering work that other people aren't willing to, has been doing a lot of zone entry stuff, and I'd be really interested to see, because Kopitar and Brown have always been guys who will carry the puck in, and if they dump it, it's sort of a half dump. Kopitar has been doing that move a lot more this year, where he flicks the puck about 10 feet away from him and then gets to it before the defender can react, which is a really fun one. But the puck control and the aggressiveness, Kopitar still does that, carry the puck in gently and hold it, nestling it close to his body like a toddler until he can find somebody. But he has been doing more of the attacking as well, and the play yesterday was just another indication. So it's been a nice development to see that even the bounce back we were all expecting has escalated beyond we were expecting. The question again that I've seen, there's, you know, Kopitar and Brown are attached to the hip and they deserve to be, but the Kings got Tobias Reeder, they've still got Alex Iafallo, which again, I'm springing questions on you without even noting that they were going to be sprung, but which of those guys would you rather see on the top line, assuming that you keep Carter and Pearson to fully together for a while?
I still like Iafallo up there. You know, he obviously hasn't provided the offense, maybe kind of hoped he would, but I think it's just such a good fit. Reeder's been, he was good in the one game that, you know, he was up there. He had something like 6 shots on goal the time that he was with them. But I like, you know, I also definitely have to retract some of my grumbling about Tobias Reeder whenever we first made that trade as well, because his numbers, as I learned very quickly after watching him play, they're not really indicative of the player that he is. His numbers are much more of a, like, grinder kind of, I chip in some dirty goals. But
sounds like I have follow.
Yeah, but he's real fast. And on a team that the biggest criticism of it has been everyone on this team is slow, it's kind of refreshing to see him. And I think that as he gets more comfortable as he gets a regular line, first off, and gets more comfortable with his teammates, you know, I think he'll be able to chip in more. And so I think it was probably, it had to have been you who suggested, you know, pairing him and Kempe together and then just insert dude here on the other wing, which I would really like to see more of.
Yeah, it was a lot of people. I won't take too much credit for it, but that's I think the Kempe Reader Lewis line is one that a lot of fans were throwing around right after that trade.
Yeah, I mean, I've been pleasantly surprised. I definitely, my brain hurts every time I see like short, beardy, dark haired dude wearing number 10. I still am like, no, that Mike Richards is like drinking beer and fishing. It's not him. So I still have some association problems that I need to work out. I'm like, first off, this guy's a much better skater. But yeah, I think you're
starting to see differences.
yeah. I don't think you mess with the chemistry though of the first line. I think that they've developed well together and can take on the kind of defensive assignments. I don't know how defensively strong Tobias Reeder is. So putting him up there on the top line gives a little more, you know, speed to the net, but if he's going to be not quite as good along the wall or anything as, you know, I follow, like, let's just spread out the goodness. It's not often that the Kings can do that.
Yeah, and Five for Howling, I know the SB Nation and Arizona Coyotes blog was pretty complimentary of Reeder from a defensive perspective. Maybe some, like you said, some misgivings about the assertion that he was going to provide the scoring punch the Kings wanted him to, but. Yeah, I think he's a reasonably good fit. I don't think we've gotten a chance to see his defensive work to the extent that I was interested in. But overall, it seems like he's always been a reasonably good fit, if not a, you know, Jeff Carter-esque deadline acquisition.
Right.
Elliot Friedman today actually mentioned that Gustav Nyquist was the Kings' plan A in terms of a scoring winger. At least they took a look at Gustav Nyquist in Detroit prior to getting Reeder. So there was definitely, I think, from Rob Blake, he knew what he wanted. And I think given that these days there are so few teams who are openly selling at the deadline, I think he did all right, at least getting a reasonable piece for a backup goalie. And was that it? I think, oh yeah. And, no, I think that was it. Maybe I'm forgetting somebody, in which case I'm very sorry for insulting that person, but, the line with Kemper, with Thompson and Phaneuf, and Reeder, so far has worked out reasonably well. We'll see how the rest of the stretch run goes for those guys. I guess we're maybe 10, 15 minutes away from the end of the podcast, so we've got enough time to talk about the rest of the season. We've already talked about a lot of the players. Let's talk about the schedule real quick, because the Kings have more home games left, I think, than almost any team in the league. The Kings' home form hasn't been, you know, particularly good compared to their road record, but the stretch run, it's interesting. Three of their last four games are against teams that are on night two of a back-to-back. Four of their last five, actually. And they've only got a couple back-to-backs. Like I said, those three back-to-backs, with two of them featuring games against Arizona. I don't think there's any team in the Pacific that has that sort of advantageous schedule. The Ducks have a similar setup where they're mostly rested down the stretch, and they have a back-to-back on the last two games of the season, but they play Arizona. Aside from that, San Jose, I think, has a couple of road trips remaining. Calgary has a lot of road games down the stretch, and they seem to have a tough schedule. They still got to go through some of the East. So going the rest of the way, do you think that the Kings are positioned to make a run, not just at a playoff spot, but maybe even get to that number two spot in the Pacific?
Oh, I hate the rest of the schedule. It's all Western teams, and they're all I feel more optimistic if they play the way that they did those last two games against Vegas. There's a handful of teams on here that Chicago's thrown in the towel. The Blues might as well have thrown in the towel. Detroit exists. Vancouver, I'm sorry about their lives. There's enough teams on here that are non-playoff teams that theoretically should be an easy game, there's a handful of games that I'm like, these should be two easy points. And if that is the case, they'll be well positioned at least to squeak into the playoffs. Given how poor they've done at home, I don't know that they actually want home ice advantage this year. For some reason, Staples has not been kind to them. We've seen the Kings do damage no matter where they squeak into the playoffs at. I would like to see them in that two or three spot to avoid any sort of potential first round Vegas matchup, because I don't want to have to see Vegas at all ever, but especially not before we have to. As long as they could maybe stay there and let some other teams battle it out in the wild card. I know that Calgary, I think Mike Smith is still hurt. The rookie goalie they have in for him has been doing fine, but that could really hurt their chances going forward. We have at least one game at the end of the month against Calgary, who now has acquired Nick Shore. So I'll be sitting in front of my television probably crying during that game. he might be the secret weapon for Calgary. Who knows? There's enough teams on here that are meh that the Kings should be fine, but I don't know how much I trust them anymore.
Yeah, in goal for the Calgary Flames tonight is David Rittich or Rittich, who has a .902 save percentage in 15 games this season. Naturally, he's stopped all 11 shots in the first period against Colorado. But I believe it's him and as you'd expect. Is it John Gillies that's the other guy that's with the Flames now?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it should logically open up for LA, and they're only 2 points behind San Jose. I just assume that they're gonna run into San Jose if they make the playoffs, because that's just sort of been
right.
The law in the NHL.
It's a secret law.
I think earlier this season, I think it was Travis Yost who, I'm like dropping a lot of names of people that I don't know but read today. So read all their work, they're all good. But Travis Yost posted earlier, I think earlier this month, what the setup would be if the playoffs were not seeded by conference, but just by the 16 best records. And I believe San Jose was either the first or the second round matchup for LA. So even if you decide you want to reseed everything to allow East-West matchups, San Jose will still be waiting in the wings.
Go away.
Yeah, so start booking your hotels, I guess. Still a long way to go. But once Trevor Lewis is back, the Kings are healthy, which is pretty exciting. The schedule shapes up well in terms of home matchups, maybe not as well in terms of team matchups. But like you said, there's a lot of West teams, and there's a lot of teams that the Kings, there's a lot of four-point games in terms of the playoff race. They have games with St. Louis and Minnesota and Winnipeg and Colorado and Calgary and Anaheim and Colorado and Minnesota and Dallas again. So it's going to be hairy, I think. but hey, there's a lot of optimism or a lot of optimism, at least after Vegas. Tomorrow's game, I believe, is against Columbus. Yeah, they've got Columbus and Chicago, and then they actually have like 3 or 4 days off. I think we're probably going to come back for another podcast with maybe more of the crew next week. But for now, I think that's pretty much where everything stands. Sarah, did we get any questions or comments or anything, or did you have anything else you wanted to talk about?
I got some questions about my cats, but I'll answer those off the podcast. I'm just glad that all of our prayer candles for Jeff Carter worked and that he's back, and that I still demand that the NHL just give me a video feed of Jeff Carter for the whole game. Like, even if he's just sitting on the bench talking, that's fine. I just need to be reassured that he's still there and isn't going to go away. We can also do like a Kopitar ISO cam too. Like, that would be really great as well. So there's my broadcasting idea. I would like that.
Carter is just so explosive, even when he's sitting on the bench. It's remarkable.
Great ratings. I'd watch it.
Mm-hmm. I guess the last thing I'll ask about, just so we can get to a nice clean hour, Toffoli and Pearson. Do you think that Jeff Carter is going to provide them the boost that they need? Are you expecting more or less from them down the stretch? Do you just have feelings in general?
I mean, I always have feelings about Tyler Toffoli and Tanner Pearson. I do think that, you know, they'll benefit from playing with Jeff Carter. I think that, you know, eventually, you know, someday in the future, they're going to have to learn to play better with a different center, because Jeff can't always be there. But, you know, I do think that his absence really did do a number on their production. So I think that, you know, as they get back up to speed as a trio, I expect more from both of them coming down the stretch, and, you know, hopefully in the playoffs, they'll be clicking like a very well-oiled machine, and everything will be beautiful.
I like it. And yeah, I think on a team where a lot of the players have seen their possession or their Corsi numbers drop over the course of the season, just because they're playing under John Stevens and not Daryl Sutter, Toffoli and Pearson, I think, are still near the top, at least on the Kings, among forwards. And maybe that's just a function of, well, Kopitar and Brown are obviously going to be good in that respect, and Toffoli and Pearson similarly are going to be fine too. But I think people are more concerned about Pearson at this point, because Toffoli, you assume he's going to get his goals. But Pearson has just looked, I think, like a different player to a lot of people. What do you think is the right move with? Are you leaving them with Carter the rest of the season and letting them go out, all the way home? Are you going to try and put Pearson with Kopitar at any point? What's your thought?
No, I mean, I think you leave them with Carter. I think that you can switch them around. I'd probably actually, if I had to change anything, you know, since Kempe's proved himself as a fine center, that, you know, if we need to load up, I'd put Carter on the top line, and, you know, he can become BFFs with Kopitar for a little bit. I think you keep them together, and I think you let them develop that rhythm. You know, they keep trying putting, you know, Pearson with Kopitar, and it never really quite works out as well as anyone wants it to. Pearson's shooting percentage has plummeted. Last year he was at 12.8%. This year he's at 7.1%. So that's his problem. He's just, for whatever reason, he's taking about the same amount of shots, maybe a little less. He's just not getting them on target into the net. And I don't think that has anything to do with his line mates. I think that's just, you know, he needs to work on his shot over the summer. You know, whatever magic voodoo happens that makes players suddenly be able to not score goals, he needs to figure that out. Toffoli, he has more points than he had last year in the one more game. And, you know, last year he was playing kind of injured for a while. He has 21 goals. Like, he'll be fine. I think his shooting percentage is higher than last year. It's about a little under his career average, but yeah, Pearson, it's just, mm-hmm. I think he'll bounce back. I think he's just having a crummy year for putting pucks in the net. He has the same amount of assists as last year. And he still has, 20 some games to go. So yeah, I think it's just correcting whatever went wrong in his shot. And I think he'll bounce back. It's just a little frustrating to see because I know that everyone expected more out of him, but it is what it is.
Yeah, and I think that's like the second or third time on a podcast where I've completely neglected Tanner Pearson's assist numbers when talking about him. So, Tanner, my mistake. You're doing great. Good job finding assists when you're not playing with Jeff Carter. And the last thing I will ask, because you have been notorious for commenting on the facial hair of some of these players, very publicly, even though you did not mean to, Tyler Toffoli's facial hair. I noticed it a lot more last night.
It's so bad.
Tell me, what do you think he's going for here?
I really want to like message his fiance or something and be like, please get your man under control. It's just, oh man, if I had to pick, like, Tanner Pearson's facial hair being better than anyone's is really sad. He just needs to give up. Just give up. It's fine. Like, we won't judge you. We all love the rest of your hair. You don't need to do this, Tyler, if you're listening. Please. Please stop.
And I will add that I'm allowed to comment on it because I once tried to grow a mustache during Movember and it was visible on like November 29th. So I come from a sympathetic place on this. but maybe Tyler Toffoli wants to have it. So once we get to April, if the Kings are in the playoffs and have, a decent starting point. I know that some people
cheating.
Think that's cheating, but I thank you. Okay. So some people, including Sarah, think that's cheating. But I sympathize. We'll see if the Kings go on a run and play until June, and maybe we'll see that Tyler Toffoli had a long-term plan all along.
He needs all the help he can get there.
Yeah.
I'll let him cheat.
I understand. So I think, On that note, I think we'll go ahead and call it a night for the JewelCast. So thanks for listening to everybody who listened live or has decided to download this and listen after the fact. We've got two games this week we'll be covering for you, as always, and then a little bit of a break and then a pretty relentless stretch run. So it should be fun. The Kings have recovered from the swoon that put them in real trouble, and now they're like six other teams in the West just sort of fighting for a spot. So we'll probably be back next week or the week after with another podcast, and we'll try to do it a few more times leading up to the end of the regular season and hopefully some playoff games as well. So Sarah, thanks for coming on again.
Absolutely.
And we'll be back soon. Thanks, everybody.